Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I hope you're all having a fantastic summer. Throughout August, we have been sharing some of our all-time favourite Power Hour episodes, and this week we're going to share one more. This is an interview that I did last year in April with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee. Dr. Chatterjee is one of the most influential doctors in the UK. He's been a practicing GP for more than two decades. He is a best-selling author with a number of books, and he's also the host of the Feel Better, Live More podcast. I really enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Chatterjee. We met in Soho and we recorded in the studio there. I think it was actually the day of publication of one of his books. And he's just a really lovely guy. And I think he's done an incredible job of really sharing some kind of complex and thoughtful ideas in a really simple and actionable way. When it comes to health, he really is on a mission to encourage people to just take care of their physical and mental health, to feel better, to live well, and he just does a really great job of that. So let's dive in to Power Hour 2022 with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee.
Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals.
Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Rangan Chatterjee. Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, wow, I mean, he is a man on a mission to inspire people to transform their health and happiness, and he is empowering us all to make meaningful and sustainable change to our lifestyles. Dr. Rangan, welcome to the Power Hour.
Adrian, I'm pretty excited to come on the show.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this one for lots of reasons, but mostly because we're actually together in London in the studio. You know, for the last 2 years, I've been recording remotely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I know we thought about doing it remotely before, but I actually said to my team, I said, look, I want to meet you, actually. I really like your stuff online. I thought, I want to do it in person with you. So it feels really good to be here, sat next to you, having this conversation.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, I think there's definitely pros and cons, of course, to the remote world. And, you know, you do a lot of broadcast and virtual online work too. And I think, you know, I've been able to connect with people all over the world, different time zones, different places. But I really love being able to sit opposite you, have this conversation face to face. And do you think that, how do you think it compares? I suppose we've all got used to now the virtual world. How do you think it compares when you can sit face to face with someone?
I think it's a very different experience sitting face to face. As you say, there's of course loads of benefits we get from online communication, but we also miss something. And, you know, depending on what study you read, 60 to 90% of all communication is non-verbal. So this is why I think things like emails and text messages often get misconstrued, because actually it's just the words, but you're not even hearing the words, where you at least get tone of voice and that sort of nuance. You're just, it's very transactional. It's very one-dimensional communication. And, you know, as humans, we can have this beautiful three-dimensional communication when we're face-to-face. So, yes, I use online communication as and when I need to. But as a fellow podcast host, you know, I, until the pandemic, I didn't do any remote interviews. I wouldn't do it. It all had to be face-to-face. And then I adapted, like everyone, and I've had some great conversations online, sure. But I tell you the difference. I don't feel I know that person. You know, it's like, you know what it's like when you're doing a Zoom call? Like, you've got other things to do beforehand, then you show up on the meeting, you have it, and then you get on with your day.
Yeah.
But even that, we have a little chat before we're recording, and afterwards, we'll say, you know, well, I think that's what a key part of the human experience is, these real world communications. And I think we're missing it. And I even think with, you know, working from home, a lot of people, it was quite a novelty at first.
Yeah.
Oh, this is amazing. I'd have to get on the train or do this. And wow, I can go for a walk every morning. Okay, great. Of course, there are benefits. But there's a lot of people now who are missing getting out of the house, having that social connection with other people. And it's not even, Adrienne, about just seeing good friends or work colleagues, right? Those things are amazing. But I've written a whole chapter in my latest book on why talking to strangers is so important, yep. Right?
Yep.
And we have a part of our brain that scientists call the sociometer. And that sociometer is constantly scanning the world for threats. You know, is my external world safe? So if we meet another human being, let's say the postman drops something in, and instead of just taking the mail or missing them, you'd say, hey, how's it going? Oh, thanks so much. Have a good day. And they say something back to you. That's a message to your sociometer. Oh, yeah, you know what? The outside world is safe. Everything's okay. When you go and buy a coffee, you know, sure, you can make a coffee at home. I like making coffee at home. But there's also something nice about going to a coffee shop, the ambience, someone making it for you. So I think, yeah, I mean, we could talk for a whole hour just on that topic. I'm very passionate about it. But I do think for all its benefits, this online communication world, we have to be very, very careful that it's not this rich three-dimensional experience that we can get face to face.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I agree with so much of what you said. And I'm interested really to see where it goes from here, because I'm somebody who, you know, I'm really passionate about innovation. I'm always thinking really about how things change and evolve, everything from our behavior to technology, everything. And especially with being a parent, I'm sure you probably think about, you know, the future for young people. And I'm really interested to see how it evolves, this hybrid world, especially for education as well, you know, for people that are learning, as you described. What are they missing if they are doing online learning, if we're doing things more virtually, more remote, more by ourselves, more, yeah, in solitude? What, there's benefits, but what are we missing? And yeah, I'm really interested to see where it will go.
Yeah, you know, there's as well as online learning, there's this wonderful book that I think you will love called Reclaiming Conversation by someone called Sherry Turkle in America. And she basically outlines how lots of youngsters and teenagers now prefer to communicate online than face-to-face. And one of the reasons is because they feel it's more predictable.
Wow.
Right? So you get a text message. You can think about it. You can write your response. You can edit it. You can get it just right and then send it back. Whereas face-to-face, you can't edit. You have to respond in the moment. And that this comes at a huge cost because actually then we're trying to edit every part of our communication and make it all perfect. But real life communication in the moment is imperfect. Like, we're face to face, right? And of course we could do this online, but because we're having a conversation, you know, we could have this conversation on five different days and there'll be five different conversations because you could ask the same questions, but I'll be a different person.
Yeah,
I'll show up with a different morning, a different amount of sleep last night, different stresses in my life. So I think we need to embrace that imperfection and go, no, this is what it means to be human. We can't curate and control every aspect of our life, and it's okay for it to be like a little bit messy.
And to be honest, I think people appreciate that much more now than ever before.
You know,
I was at an event last night, actually. I was speaking, and first it was so, again, great to be in a room full of women. But secondly, I think sometimes what the feedback I get from people afterwards is like, thank you for being honest, because I don't always just, you know, give the perfect answer or deliver it in the way that it's so formal. Sometimes I'm just like, you know what, let me just tell you the truth. This, in my experience, this was my, and people really appreciate, I think, now more than ever, actually real honest conversation that doesn't feel super scripted or sound like you've you know, you're trying to come across a certain way. You actually can just be yourself, and people really respect that.
I think that's one of the reasons that podcasting is exploding and why I dearly love the medium as a, you know, creator and a host of podcasts, but also a consumer, because I think people are getting tired of a very inauthentic way of being and communicating. You know, we're recording this in launch week, right, for my book. So I've, you know, this is my fifth book in 5 years. So I've done a lot of publication weeks. And the difference when you go on a BBC show or an ITV show, you've got about 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? It's 4 minutes live to try and communicate.
A whole book
and a nuance. And yes, there's an art and a skill to being able to do that, for sure. But it can only ever be surface level. It can't go deeper, right? Whereas when I like come on your show or I go and appear on other podcasts, you can get into the nuance and the depth. And, you know, one thing, how long have you had your podcast for now?
3.5 years.
3.5 years. Congratulations.
Yes,
yeah,
you.
Man, that is, yeah, I'm, what am I, just over 4 years, 4 years and 2 months. So
yeah,
pretty similar times.
Time, yeah.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. When I started, which is maybe 6 months or so before you, I remember people saying, hey, Rongan, listen, you know, the perfect length for a podcast in the UK is about 40 minutes. That's the average length of a commute.
Sure.
I was like, okay, I didn't know what I was doing at the start.
Yeah.
You know, you just start doing it. You think, is anyone going to listen?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just see what happens. And I would do these 40-minute conversations. And there's nothing wrong with that. People enjoyed them. But I didn't feel, I always felt, there's something left here. There's something unexplored. Mm. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to follow my heart here. And I went longer and longer. Now, sometimes it's an hour and a half. Sometimes it's 2 hours,
yeah,
right? And as they've got longer, they've got more popular, right? So by breaking the rules of what you're meant to do, and I just followed my heart, more and more people listen. What I found in these long conversations, Adrienne, is that the second half always is better than the first half.
Yeah.
Because you've built up that connection. You've sort of not jabbed around, but, you know, you built up trust and you go deeper.
Yeah.
And I think that podcasting for me is the modern day campfire.
Mm.
Right. Yeah. We're missing connection in so many aspects of our lives. So people will listen to me or you and they'll go on their walks and we're the soundtrack to their walk or their commute.
Yeah.
We're getting that sense of community through this beautiful medium of podcasting, which I think is very rich and very human.
Oh, I agree. I listen to a lot of long-form podcasts as well. And I think you're totally right. The depth that you get as the conversation progresses, you might go in a different direction. And as a host of the show, there's nothing worse than feeling, as you described, you know, if I do broadcast or in different things where there's a limit on the time, there's nothing worse than if I was thinking now, looking at you, looking at the clock and thinking, oh, I've got to get to this question. It definitely changes the whole dynamic. And it can feel rushed. And it can feel, as you said, surface. You don't get the nuances. You don't get the complex back and forth. It just has to be quite black and white.
And I think people are craving this, right? How can long-form podcasting be so popular? There's some huge US shows doing long-form podcasting. You know, the reach I have on my show is just incredible. No, I couldn't even have dreamed about it several years ago when I started it. And if it's true that no one has attention anymore, if it's true that everyone wants it very quick because we can't concentrate, well, why on earth are some of the biggest podcasts on the planet 2 hours long or 2.5 hours long? Why? I think it's because fundamentally we are craving authentic connection. And I think we're sick and tired of overly edited, inauthentic connection. And I think, you know, I wonder where kind of traditional broadcast media will be in 5 or 10 years. Personally, I think it's so different.
Yeah. Well, let's see. And sit tight if you're listening, because as you can tell, we've got a lot to get through. And I'm so excited to... You mentioned that it's publication week. I am so excited to dive in and talk to you about your latest book. I have so many questions, so many thoughts that came up for me, because I was lucky enough to receive an early digital version. So, you know, I've got so many things within it that I just want to talk to you about today. Firstly, I've got to say congratulations, because I was going to say, you know, you've written 4 best-selling books, but this is book number 5. And it is already a bestseller, and it's just incredible. So, you know, all of your hard work, all of your well-deserved success, you know, people probably see what you do and think, well, of course you have a team, and of course there's, you know, always a machine, I guess, that also helps. But the reality is you've managed to do something that not many medical professionals can do. And I think you reach people in a way that makes them feel as though they have agency. It makes them feel like, oh, this is something I can do. You don't shame people or blame people or make them feel like, well, you know, you're not doing this right, or you're not doing that, you know, eating that food or exercising this way or sleeping enough, or everyone's doing their best. And I think that actually what you've done so well for so many people, probably more than you'll ever know, is for people young, old, you know, big, small, different genders, different races, different ethnicities, to go, actually, I can do that. I might not be able to do it perfectly. I might not be able to do everything in the book, but there's a lot in here for me. And as you've seen from the amount of, you know, people that read your books and listen to your work, you really do help and reach so many people.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that. Thank you. You know, I think a lot of this comes from the fact that I've got real life experience of seeing tens of thousands of people. You know, in a couple of months, it'll be 21 years of seeing patients. That's a long time. That's tens of thousands of patients. And what you learn, if you're really open-minded and listen to people, is that everyone's different. Everyone's got different lives. Everyone's got different pressures, different cultural beliefs, different ethics. There is no one right way. There are some general principles, but there's no one right way. So I've always struggled to, you know, I believe in personalized medicine. I believe that we need to help people develop personalized plans for them that suit them. But then when you're trying to write a book, and you know it from writing The Power Hour, how do you deliver personalization in a book that you've written for the mass market?
Yep.
And I hope, I'd like to think I've managed to do it because I provide frameworks for people. There's no kind of Dr. Chatterjee plan to follow, right? It's kind of, no, these are the broad principles. What's going to work for you within that? You know, let me help you figure out what's going to work for you. And I think that's what's resonated. You know, the way you talk to people and treat people, I think is the most important thing. I try my best to do is always behave with compassion and respect. I don't talk down about other people online. You know, I don't try and elevate my ideas at the expense of anybody else, which is very common these days. And it's just not how I want to do things. I don't want to contribute to negativity in the world, because I think how we do the small things is how we do everything. And so for me, how you come across and how you behave is really, really important. And I think that's one of the things that people kind of resonate with is it's like, I also don't tell people what to do, Adrian, right? Yeah. I've said this before. I don't know if you've ever heard me say this, but I've never told a patient what to do. I've never told a patient that they have to give up smoking. What I will do if a patient comes in to see me and asks for my opinion, I will say, hey, listen, well, I think your smoking is affecting you in these three ways. And if you were to reduce or give up, I think you would get these improvements. If at the end of that conversation, they say to me, Dr. Chatterjee, look, I've heard you, I've understood that, but actually, I get so much enjoyment out of that cigarette that I'm prepared to put up with the consequences. I actually respect that.
It's a choice, isn't it?
It's a choice. And as a fellow human being, I don't feel I've got any right to tell someone else what to do. Now, the second stage of that is, I happen to get really good compliance with my patients. And I think the reason I do is because I don't talk down to them. I do treat them as an equal. And I totally value their opinion in terms of them deciding what's right for them. And I kind of feel this is a big piece of health that, like, we often miss. Sure, buy a book, get some ideas, follow a plan. But at some point, it has to become your plan. You have to, let's say they like the idea of the Power Hour, right? And I do, and I have a Power Hour.
Great.
Right? So I can't wait to talk about that. I've been a huge fan of morning routines for many, many years. They've really set me up for the whole of my day. When I do them, I'm a different person. When I don't do them. But I think people need a framework and go, okay, well, maybe an hour won't work for me, or maybe I can do half an hour, or, oh, well, she does yoga in hers, but I don't really like yoga. I think I'd rather do some breathwork or some Pilates. And I like frameworks so that people can personalize for them.
Yep.
I don't know, have you found that to be helpful?
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree that giving suggestions, giving ideas, giving frameworks, giving people the tools themselves to say, okay, great, okay, this is something I want to work on. And also knowing that person knows what's going on in their life. They know when it's the time to make those changes, when it's going to be the most impactful for them. And I want to bring it back to the book, because as I said, so many things in there that I want to talk to you about. And so the new book, Happy Mind, Happy Life, offers 10 simple ways to feel great every day. Now, I'm really interested to talk specifically about the idea of happiness. Happiness is something I believe we all want. I'm sure that we can all think of a time in our lives when we've been really happy, or a time when we've been deeply unhappy, and we can probably list people, places, moments that we can remember, maybe a photograph or a video, something where we've been really, really happy. But the thing about happiness is, you know, it's defined as an emotional state. It's characterized by a feeling of joy, contentment, satisfaction. It's not something that you just have and then that's it. You have it forever. You know, it constantly changes. So I think my first question about happiness is, if it is something that's constantly changing, I think everybody wants it. I think everybody seeks it. Do you believe that with all the work and the research that you've done, do you think it's possible for us to be happy every single day?
It depends on the definition of happiness. Mm-hmm. And I think happiness is one of those terms that we could say it to 10 different people and they'll interpret that in 10 different ways. Mm-hmm. So I do agree with you that every one of us wants to feel happy as often as we can.
Yep.
I think that's become a bit unfashionable these days because I think many of us feel that happiness is having a smile on our face the whole time. And many of us feel it's waiting for everything to be perfect in our lives, where we don't have any problems at work, everyone treats us really nicely, the world is a certain way. The problem is that's never going to happen, right? These are external factors that we can't control. So therefore, I have a definition of the book as something that I call core happiness. So everything that I've tried to do in my public-facing career, and frankly with my patients as well, is make things practical. So sure, let's come up with a great idea. You know, happiness can seem like quite a vague concept sometimes. It's just this, it's almost like a mirage that for whatever reason, one day I might just feel happy and I want to grab it and bottle it when it's there, but the next day it's gone and it's vanished. But I don't see it like that. So I'm going to explain to you what I mean by core happiness. I've tried to develop what I think is a universal model of happiness that holds true in every situation. And as of yet, I haven't found a situation where it doesn't hold true, although I'm not attached to it, so I welcome if anyone has got a situation where it doesn't. I'm always looking to learn and get better. I'm really curious. But so far, I think it holds true. And for me, core happiness, the happiness that I think we all want, has these three key components. Think of it like a three-legged stool, right? Mm-hmm. Each of the legs is separate, but each of the legs is essential. And if one of those legs is weak and you're not strengthening it, your feelings of happiness will start to collapse. And the three legs are, number one, alignment. What's alignment? Alignment is when the person who you really are inside and the person who you are actually being out there in the world are one and the same.
Yep.
It's when your inner values and your external actions start to match up. Now, I firmly believe that many of us are living out of alignment. I've lived most of my life out of alignment. I've tried to be someone in order to get external validation from the world around me, right? I wanted to be accepted and fit in, right? And I know where that comes from in my childhood very, very clearly. That's a very lonely place to be, right? You're not really living your life. You're living somebody else's life. And certainly for me, when my dad died just over 9 years ago, that was the moment where I started to ask myself all these existential questions. Who am I? Whose life am I really leading? So that's one leg, alignment. The second leg is contentment. Contentment is the sort of things you do in your life that give you that sense of calm and peace. I think we all know naturally contentment. So, yeah, I know what things make me feel content. The third leg, which I think is really important at the moment, because I don't think those two legs are enough. I don't think alignment is enough in and of itself. I don't think contentment is. And to come up with a complete model, I had this final leg, which I call control. Now, again, control is a word that I ummed and ahed about. Yeah. This word can easily be misinterpreted. This is not about controlling the world. The world is inherently uncontrollable, right? We've seen that the last 2 years, right? You may want the world to be a certain way, but it will do what it's going to do. So it's not about controlling the world around you, because if you're waiting for that level of control in order to be happy, you're going to wait a long, long time. This is about a sense of control. What are the things that you can do day to day, like the power hour, for example, right, that give you that sense of control over your life? Because we know from the research, people who have a sense of control, they have higher motivation. They have higher academic success. They earn more money. They are healthier. They live longer and they're happier. So this sense of agency, this sense of control is really, really important. So these three legs, I think, are what core happiness is, and the happiness that all of us deep down really want. And what I think, or I hope, is really useful for people is that you can work directly on these legs. That's, yeah, there's a lot of simple, I say low cost tools, free tools. Everything in the book is free to do. Yep. That actually are going to help you work on those stools. Those legs of the stool. Mm. And that's going to mean your core happiness tool is going to be much more stable. You're going to have the side effect of feeling happier more often, right? Yep. So you're not directly working on happiness. You're working on alignment, contentment, and control. The side effects, and what a beautiful side effect, is that you're going to feel happier more often. Now, can I just compare core happiness to another term I have in the book that I call junk happiness? Mm-hmm. Junk happiness.
I'm going to put a pin though. I'm going to come back to these three from a personal, as you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, how does that
okay, well, I'll just try and briefly summarize ahead. Junk happiness. Junk happiness is the opposite of core happiness, right? Mm-hmm. So a junk happiness habit, we all have a go-to junk happiness habit, at least one, if not more. That could be sugar. It could be alcohol. It could be 3 hours on Instagram. It could be online shopping. It could be gambling, right? Something to distract ourselves, something that gives us that hit, often when we don't want to face the reality of life. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with a junk happiness habit. The problem, I think, comes is when we engage in these things too often, we don't understand why we're engaging in them, or we make the big mistake that those things are bringing us this deep level of core happiness, when most of the time they're really not.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of separate the two things. So I do think we all want to be happy, but I put it through the lens of core happiness, which doesn't mean you have to have a smile on your face every day. You can still have high levels of core happiness and actually feel pretty sad sometime, which might seem like a contradiction.
No, I love this framework. I really love this framework. And the reason I wanted to put a pin in that, the three pillars part, is because I feel like personally reflecting, I'm thinking, okay, the alignment part, I do a lot of work on this. You know, I do mentoring, I do workshops literally about this, about helping people understand their core values, understand what is the most important thing, the most meaningful thing to you in your life. If you had to eliminate everything else, what remains? And so I feel like for me, the alignment part, I'm like, yes, my work aligns with what I do. Hopefully my lifestyle and my actions, my behaviors align. So that feels great. The third one, control. I agree with you. The word people say, oh, you can't control everything. But again, I'm a big advocate of influence. I think there's so many things we can do to influence the outcome. So like you say, daily habits, diet, sleep, who you listen to, what you feed your mind, what you feed your body, influence and control. I'm like, got it. Tick. The one that I struggle with, which I want to talk to you about, is the contentment piece. And I think that this is something that I've interrogated, especially over the last few years. And I think, you know, I'm somebody who's very ambitious. I think a lot of people who listen to this show are high achieving people. You know, they might be, they're probably healthy people. They invest in, you know, they're runners, they're people who listen to your work, and they're very, self-motivated, ambitious people. I think where the contentment piece comes in for me is I know that I'm someone who feels validated by achievement. I know I'm someone who, and for a lot of people who listen, probably look left and right. And that comparison feeling of, well, I think the feeling of what I'm trying to describe is, on the one hand, I'm incredibly grateful for where I am, what I have, what I've achieved, but I also know I feel validated by achievement. So therefore, I'm always chasing the next achievement. I'm almost working towards the next goal, the next marathon, the next book, the next whatever. And as a result, I think for a lot of people at the moment in the world, the contentment piece, it's so hard, because you can always go, yeah, I'm super abundant, I'm so lucky, I've got food in the fridge, I'm healthy, I've got friends, I've got everything. But, and with that but, I think is where people's unhappiness comes, because there's always something you could look at and think, but I haven't got that yet, or I haven't done this yet, or, you know, bigger house, bigger car, bigger whatever. So tell us, why are we all struggling with the contentment piece?
I think you've just brought up such a great point and such an important point, and I can resonate with that.
It's like personal therapy for me now.
More deeply than you could possibly imagine. And I'll share why in just a moment. So first thing I'm going to ask you is, do you know where that drive to succeed comes from?
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I do. I think, you know, I grew up in a family of four. My single mother did her best, but, you know, it was very much a... I guess, fight for attention at home. Yeah. And I think at school, my teachers didn't expect much from me or my siblings. They really didn't expect much from any of us. And I think it partly came from a feeling of a bit of a chip on my shoulder, a bit of a, well, I'll show you. You know, you don't think that I can achieve anything. And actually, look, I'll show you. Me and all my siblings have all achieved a lot. But secondly, I think that when I am achieving things, people say to you, well done. We congratulate people when they do good things. We congratulate our children when they come first in the race. People congratulate you when your book is a bestseller. That feeling of people saying, well done, they see you. You're offering something of value, which makes you feel worthy. And I know this is really, really deep, but I really, as I said, have interrogated this. And I understand now that that's where I get my feeling of I'm doing something of value to someone. So therefore, they're going to want me around.
Yeah. And that's where the opportunity, I would say, for your growth lies, right? It's in that, because if we're always chasing more, and I'm speaking from experience here as well as hopefully a level of expertise, it's an unwinnable game, right? Success, defining your self-worth on success is unwinnable, right? If someone's metric was money in terms of how well they're doing in life, well, until you're Jeff Bezos, someone's always got more than you. So it doesn't matter how much you get, someone's always getting more. And you see this commonly. I think there's a study which showed you ask anyone, a whole range of people were asked, you know, how much money would you need to feel okay about your life? Everyone said about 30% more. Doesn't matter whether you're earning 30 grand a year, 100 grand a year, a million a year. Everyone just wants that little bit more, then life would be good. So for me, it comes down to, where does that desire to succeed come from? I'm broadening this out beyond you, right? Because I'm talking to myself here as well. Is it coming from a place of lack or a place of love? A lot of our ambition comes from a place of lack. If I achieve that, I'll show them. What will it say to somebody else? But that intention never leads to true contentment, right? My story on that is immigrant parents from India to the UK, 1960s and 1970s, faced a lot of discrimination, right? Really, really struggling. They certainly, I know in many immigrant families this is the case, but certainly in Indian families that I'm experienced with, there is a huge amount of motivation. Huge amount of effort is put into academic success.
Get a profession.
Because for my parents, if you do well at school, you won't have to face the same problems as we had. So what happens then? And there's a perspective here, and perspective actually is a big part of happiness. Knowing that you can take different perspectives on the same situation is a skill I only developed in the last few years, but as the last few years, which is probably been at the heart of why I feel so content and calm these days in a way that I never used to. But if I'd come home from school with 19 out of 20, it was always, well, why didn't you get 20? If I came home with 99%, why didn't you get 100%? If I was second in the class ever, well, who came top? Why didn't you come top? So here's the thing. When I was writing the books, I'd be very open about a lot of my experiences in a way that I never could have done in previous books. I would have been too scared of judgments, but I've really made peace with a lot of my inner parts now, and I feel I'm able to share them openly. I said to Mum recently, hey, Mum, why did you say that to me when I was a little boy? She said, well, you know, I just want you to be the best that you could be. I know how capable you are, so I want you to be the best you could be. I didn't do the same with your brother. He has different skills and different capabilities. So from Mum and Dad's perspective, they're doing it from a place of love. They're wanting me to be the best that I can be. The problem is, little Rongan takes on the idea, which I only realized in the last 5 or 6 years, that I'm only worthy, I'm only enough when I get top marks.
Yeah.
Right? And so therefore, yeah, on the outside, things look great. You can get straight A's, go to medical school, get a nice job, have all the trappings, in inverted commas, of success, but you still don't feel good inside because there's always something more you could be doing, even in a lot of my public-facing career. You know, 7 years now since I first came on television on BBC One in 2015 with Doctor in the House. Even then, I was driven by external validation. Sure, I loved helping people, and I'm driven. I think I'm a compassionate person who really likes to help others. But I also liked the plaudits.
Yeah.
It made me feel good.
Of course.
Right? Now, as I've made peace with that, and as I've actually done the work to realize, actually, no, my external success says nothing about my self-worth as a human being. Interesting, as we talk now, this is my fifth book in 5 years, right? I promise you, this is the only book where I've not been anxious about the launch. The first four, in the weeks leading to it, you've got a little bit nervous. You know, what's going to happen?
Is it going to do as well as the last one?
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Growing.
The pressure. Yeah. Problem is when my first book, huge international bestseller, number one in all books on Amazon, right? You got a problem. That's the new bar.
Yep.
So suddenly, now I'm lucky that all books have gone to that metric, but here's the problem is that they did. Second book, third book, and fourth book all got there as well. But the feeling of joy went down each time.
Right.
I tell you, it sounds amazing. First time when I was number one in all books, I tell you, my mates from uni were WhatsApping me. Yeah. Like, mate, this is unbelievable. I was like, yeah, I can't believe it. You know, great. Real artificial elevation. Second time it happens. Yeah, cool. Really, really good. Not quite as good as the first time, but still really good. Third time.
It's an expectation now. People go.
Okay, yeah. Cool. You know, almost like that's the norm. Yeah. Fourth time, when it happened last year, just relief that it bloody happens. Do you know what I mean?
Always got another one.
Not even joy. No. But and I say this, you know, I would have felt too shy to sort of say this publicly a few years ago. You think, who can relate to that? You know, nice problem to have, mate. No. This is real, right? This is inner discontentment. Many people have to get these high levels of success to realize actually they weren't the answer. I interviewed Johnny Wilkerson last week for my podcast. I've not put it out yet. Johnny Wilkerson, if people don't know, you know, he was an England rugby player. In the last minute of the World Cup final in 2003, he kicks the winning goal that gives England the World Cup, right? He achieved all of his dreams by the age of 24. And I have a section in chapter one saying your dreams won't make you happy if you're not careful, right? And the publisher actually said, wrong, and this is pretty negative. I said, no, I'm keeping this in because I really mean it. Many of us are chasing the wrong dreams. And he describes that the minute the ball left his foot, he started to go down and feel low. They win the World Cup, he feels nothing inside. Wakes up the following day feeling empty and lonely. Right? And you'll see this story playing out over and over again. I had this beautiful conversation with someone called Pippa Grange on my podcast, who was a psychologist with the England football team for many years. And she has this gorgeous concept called winning shallow and winning deep. Right? So the question is, how do you want to win in life? Do you want to win shallow from that place of lack? I'm going to show people, I'm going to prove that I am worth something, which again, I get it. I've had that, but it comes from a place of lack. When you realize actually, no, the drive now to do well is still there, but it's different.
Yeah.
Like the reason I'm relaxed about this book is I know that this is the best book I've ever written. I know that this is literally, I think it's a fantastic book that will help anyone. And I say that with zero arrogance. That's honestly how I genuinely feel about it. Whether it does well or not, it's no reflection of who I am.
And that feeling doesn't change.
That
You're
doesn't
not
change.
For it, yeah.
You know, having children has been wonderful about this because my kids do not care whether daddy sells one copy of the book or 100,000 copies.
Yeah, my son does not care what
it's,
I'm doing.
It's a self-created narrative in your head, in my head, yeah. Right? And for many of us, that narrative keeps us going. We think we need it for success, but actually a lot of the research is saying now we don't.
Yeah.
We don't need it. We think we do. And then let's not beat ourselves up, right? You're very successful. You're doing wonderful things. You're helping so many people, right? It served you.
Right, because that's the contradiction. Because where I know that we shouldn't use these words success and happiness interchangeably, we know they're not the wrong thing. It is a trap, as you've described very, very well. It is a trap. So if we're chasing the wrong goal, if we're chasing the wrong dream, that success, no matter how big, will not replace happiness. But as you say, I know that actually having that chip on the shoulder, and I've worked on it, as I said, that drive, whatever you call it, that feeling of, for me as well, scarcity. You know, growing up with scarcity gives you ambition, gives you drive.
Exactly.
I also think if you took that away, would you achieve these things? And that's, again, for a lot of the listeners of this show, that is where they're at. They think, well, I hear you, Adrienne, I hear you, Rongan, but if I take that away, will I lose my drive and ambition? Will I still achieve? Will I still, then do I feel content and happy? It's so complex.
Do you beat yourself up in your head sometimes?
You know what? This is the thing. So when I read what you'd written about self-compassion, honestly, self-compassion to me, I used to roll my eyes because I used to think self-compassion is just, with regards to myself, not others, it's letting yourself off the hook. It's laziness. You know, self-compassion for me used to literally be, well, of course, you don't always, no one feels motivated all the time. Nobody wants to do it all the time. Roll your sleeves up and get on with it. Yeah. I used to force myself to do things even when I didn't want to because self-compassion is not something that comes easily to me at all. So yes, I do beat myself
up. Most of these things that I've written about have not come easy to me, right? It's the book I needed to write for myself, right? That which makes the best books normally is when I deeply wanted to get these ideas down because they've helped me, and actually being able to simplify this has really helped me. You know, it's so funny, Adrian, I've done so many interviews this week and the publicist, Penguin, everyone's saying, Ron, you've never been this relaxed. We've never known you. I'm totally chilled. Like,
You're happy.
I'm happy. I'm like, this interview now, me going on Chris Evans this morning, this, whether it goes well or not, is not a reflection of who I am. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you come from that place, you actually do a much better job because you're not trying to prove yourself anymore.
Yeah.
You're just speaking from the heart. Self-compassion, being kind to yourself, treating yourself as well as you might treat your child or a friend. This is not a vague, woolly concept, right? Professor Kristen Neff has studied this for over 20 years. There's probably over 1,000 published papers on this. She has shown that people who are compassionate to themselves have higher levels of motivation. They have incredible success. It's much longer lasting, the success. Because I tell you, when you beat yourself up, sure, you can succeed. But it comes in a turmoil and a cost, right? You're knackering yourself out whilst you're doing it. She's shown that people who are compassionate to themselves are healthier. They age more slowly. They have better immune system function, right? So a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't until I became familiar with her research, that when we call ourselves a loser in our heads, we think it doesn't matter. I didn't say it to anyone else. I'm just like, come on, Rongan, you loser. I can't believe you can do this. Actually, you activate your body's stress response.
Right.
When you do that, that is real.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just this thing you say into your head. No, that is absolutely real. So, you know, you can succeed and it not come from a place of deficiency. And again, it's also to recognize that a lot of these a lot of these personality traits that we have are not fixed.
Yes.
Right?
Big advocate of that.
They were adaptations that we needed to get us through. You needed it to get you through your childhood and be where you are today. The problem is a lot of them serve us in childhood, but they don't serve us as adults, as parents. Like, because you then imprint this stuff on your own kids and you're okay, wait a minute, Ron, and you need to sort this stuff out, right? So it's making peace with it, saying that worked up to a point and now it no longer serves me. You know, would you call yourself someone who's quite competitive?
Interesting question, because I don't think I'm competitive with others. I'm competitive with myself. So my comparison of the bar, if you like, or, you know, a personal in a race, for example, is always against my own time. It's never against anybody else's. So I'm competitive with myself, but not so much with others.
Yeah, that's interesting. The reason I asked is because I've been fiercely competitive my entire life. I used to be fiercely competitive. Let me reframe that. And if you'd ask any of my mates or family in the past, is Ron and competitive? 100% yes. I did not like to lose.
Right.
I would do anything to not lose. But I'm no longer competitive, right? But people say, well, that's your personality. No, it's not my personality. If you go back to my childhood again, I felt that I had to be really successful and achieve to be loved, right? I'm not blaming my parents. Right? There's different perspectives. They were trying to do the best they could for me. It's just the impression I took on. So being competitive helps me. That helps me serve that goal.
Yep.
Right? But now, having recognized where that's come from and recognized that actually, I actually am enough. I don't need that external success to validate who I am as a human being. All these little competitive tendencies I used to have, they've gone.
Really?
They've gone because it wasn't who I was. It was who I had to become. And that's been like a light bulb moment for me in my life. Like a lot of who we think we are. I mean, this is getting super deep now, right? But a lot of who we think we are is simply an adaptation to who we felt we had to be. And I honestly believe that you can unwind that and change it. I've done that.
I have as well. I really have as well. Yeah.
And it's not like I'm there. It's a constant journey. And why I think this book is going to be so helpful for people is I feel I've really distilled down and broken down these quite complex ideas sometimes into really simple concepts and simple exercises people can practice. Yeah. Can I share my favourite one?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, there's 10 chapters in the book. Each chapter is a kind of universal life lesson that I believe holds true for everyone. And if we apply it a little bit more in our life, we're going to be a little bit happier. Apply it a lot, we'll be a lot happier. And chapter 5 is really my favourite because it's the one I practice every day, and it's called Seek Out Friction. And it's this idea that we can work out every day, not in the physical gym, yep. You could do that if you want, but in the social gym. Mm. So when we interact with other people and something happens that we don't like, oh, the tone of that email really bothered me, or I can't believe that person just pulled in front of me in their car, whatever, right? Instead of wishing that that other person had behaved in a different way, I use it as a learning opportunity about myself, right? So let's say someone criticizes me online, okay? And you know what it's like to have an online persona. And, you know, really, I get it pretty rarely these days. Yeah. But when it does happen, it used to really bother me a few years ago. Right. Honestly, I used to get really cut up. I was like, oh, I'm just trying to help people. Like, why is that person being so negative? But now I've understood that actually I can look at criticism in a different way. First of all, I make sure I'm not feeling emotionally triggered. And if I am, I sort of breathe into it and just try and let that settle first. Then I go, okay, is there any truth to this criticism? Hmm. Sometimes I'm like, you know what? That's a good point.
It's hard to do that.
It's really hard, but it's a one of us. They're like, yeah, you know what? Next time I post about this topic, I could probably cover those points as well to not give the wrong idea. So you're like, oh, wicked. I've learned something. Yeah. Brilliant. If I think, no, I don't think the criticism's fair, then you can look at it and go, actually, the tone of their comment, they're probably having a really bad day. I don't know what's going on in their life, but they're trying to take it out on me. Or they've had a real difficulty with this issue and they're being totally triggered and taken out on me. Okay, I've now got compassion for them. That must be hard to feel like that. You can train yourself to do this. It feels hard, but I promise when you work out in the social gym every day when I get a bit of social friction, I use it as an opportunity to learn about myself. And if I'm really struggling, the phrase I use is, if I was that person, I'd be doing exactly the same thing as them.
Well,
that phrase has changed my life, because what that means at its core is, if I was that person with their childhood, with the bullying they had at school, with their parents, with the toxic first boss they had at the age of 17, right? If I had their life, I'd be making the same decision as them in this moment. I'd have the same worldview as them. And I know that sounds really hard, but it gets so much easier when you practice. I do this every day. Mm. And you go into every bit of social friction now with compassion and understanding. Sometimes it's harder than others, but you get to a point, and I genuinely feel that this week has been wonderful for me to be on the road, do the events, do all the media. I go, wow, this is not really stressing me out like it used to.
Right.
Because I feel when you work out in the social gym every day, you're using it as an opportunity to learn about yourself. Why has that email from my boss bothered me? Was it their tone? Or is it because I'm insecure about this topic and it's just hit on that? Every day becomes a school day.
Yes.
You can reframe every situation in life. Every situation.
What I love about this so much is, well, you've said it a few times about change. You've said the word adaptation, learning. And I think this is something that I, you know, I'm guilty of preaching at people, that you can always adapt. You can always change. You can always learn. And all of these things that you've described are a choice. So when people sometimes feel like, well, it's okay for you, Rongan, to do this, or it's all right for you, Adrienne, to tell us that, but you don't understand because I can't because of X. I can't because of Y. This is the thing I always want people to understand, is that your circumstances are going to be, everyone's going to be unique. But it doesn't dictate, as you described, when who you were before, when you said about how it's changed. The three words for me are, it's different now.
Yeah.
And just saying that, it's different now. Maybe when you were, you say 12, maybe when you were 21, maybe last year, but it's different now. And knowing that you can always change, where you start does not dictate where you end, who the expectations of others, you can always learn, improve, evolve. And it doesn't mean just, you know, like me, chasing. It doesn't mean, when I don't want people to listen to this conversation, especially as they know I am an optimist. I am positive.
Me too.
I'm not saying, you know, oh, chasing and progression is bad. But what I'm saying is, regardless of why you do it, figure out, yes, the values, the alignment, figure out why you want those things, but know that you can change your mind.
Yeah.
You can put something down that you were pursuing and go, actually, I was chasing that maybe for the wrong reason. And now it's okay if I don't see that through to the end because I don't want it anymore.
Yeah.
It's different now.
I love that. It's different now. What a wonderfully empowering three words for people. It explains, I'm just in a different state in my life. It's different now. You know, in my 20s, yeah, that kind of works. That's where I was at the time. It's different now.
Yeah.
This whole reframing piece, I think it's one of the most powerful things that we can learn to do, is realize that in every situation, there are multiple perspectives. So me as a little kid, that situation where I feel I have to get good grades the whole time, there's two perspectives. Perspective one, from my parents, driving me to be the best I can be. Other perspective is wrong and believes he's not enough unless he gets top marks. Okay, same situation, two different interpretations, right? Yeah. Every situation in life has a different interpretation. Let's say two partners having an argument. What really happened? Well, it kind of depends who you ask, right? One partner will say, this is exactly how this went down. Walk around to the other side of the table, completely different perspective off the same situation, right? So I say for the truth, I say for your happiness, the truth doesn't actually matter. What matters is that you create a happiness narrative. Right. And so this is why I love reframing situations. Or if someone cuts me up in the road, instead of the old wrongen being, man, I can't believe they did that. Did they not see me? I can't believe they should, you know, they need a new driving set. You know, whatever disempowering narrative I want to say, what does that do? That brings emotional stress into my body. That emotional stress will lead to me having to have a bit more sugar later, or a bit more time online, or a moan to my mate, some way of relieving that stress. Right. But if you can go, you know what, if I was that person, I'd do the same. You know, maybe their daughter was up with earache last night and they're knackered and they're just trying to get through. Maybe they're rushing to get to work because they're scared of losing their job and that's the only job in their family. Whatever narrative you want, you train yourself to create that regularly. It becomes your default.
Yeah.
And someone is listening and thinking, okay, Rongan, Adrienne, it's all right for you guys. You're successful. You sure you've got the time and space to do that. I don't. Well, let me tell you about one of the most powerful conversations I've had in my entire life. About a year and a half ago on my podcast, I had an incredible conversation with someone called Dr. Edith Eger. I was not the same person after that as I was before that. Okay. She was 93 years old. And when she was 16 years old, she was living in Eastern Europe. She was getting excited. She had a date with her boyfriend that night, and she was trying to choose what dress she was going to wear. They get a knock on the door. They literally, her sister and her and her two parents, get put on a train to Auschwitz concentration camp. Within 2 hours of getting there, both her parents are murdered.
Oh my gosh.
Right? Later that day, she has to dance for the senior prison guards. And she said to me, this is the first thing that I remember from that conversation, Rongan, you know, I never forget the last thing my mum said to me, which was, Edie, never forget, nobody can take from you the content that you put inside your mind. So she said, when I was dancing, I wasn't dancing in Auschwitz. In my mind, I was in Budapest Opera House. There was a full orchestra. There was a full house. I had a gorgeous dress on. That's where I was dancing. And I thought, that's pretty incredible. Then she said to me, when I was in Auschwitz, I wasn't the prisoner. The prison guards were the prisoners. They were the ones who were not free and living their life. In my mind, I was free. I was like, this is just incredible. And then the words that I think about every day, well, when she said to me, I have lived in Auschwitz, and I can tell you this. The greatest prison you will ever live inside is the prison you create inside your mind. That's what we do each day.
Wow.
Or you walk around, people are getting they're getting affected by the actions of other people. They're framing a disempowering narrative. They're waiting for the world around them to change so that they can feel a certain way.
It's your framework.
You're creating that narrative.
Yeah.
And you can change that narrative. And once you see it and understand it, you can't unsee it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's so powerful. It's changed my entire life and for lots of other people. What you just described, I really hope people will hear that and go back and listen to it again. Once you decide, you can't unsee it.
It doesn't mean you'll be perfect every time. No. Sometimes you'll go, oh man, you know what? I took the victim narrative on that. I didn't need to. Actually, I could have chosen to take it like this. Mm. And then next time it happens, it will show up for you and you'll find you're taking a different... It's just like going to the gym and lifting weights every day. You get better at lifting weights. You get stronger, right? If you practice and work out in the social gym every day, your social interactions become much better. And then going back to the core happiness stool, what happens? No one wants to be that person who feels agitated and frustrated by the actions of someone else. No one feels good in that moment. Mm. And actually what I've learned also is when we try and judge other people and make them wrong, what we're effectively trying to do is lower them so that we can feel good and elevate ourselves. That's a short-term win. It's a long-term loss. Mm. In the moment you think you're achieving something, they did that. I can't believe, I'm better than them. I would never do that. It never feels good in the long term. Yeah. So this phrase, if I were them, I'd be doing the same thing. Yes, it may be tricky sometimes, but if you start from that standpoint, you lead with compassion, and the more you do it, the easier it gets. And then when you find it easy to be compassionate to other people, you find it a lot easier to be compassionate to yourself as well.
And that is what... Oh, wow. I mean, that's what we all need right now in the world. I think we all need more compassion for others, definitely, and more compassion for ourselves. Before we move on to talk about the Power Hour, because I have to get into that with you, I think the last thing I really want the listeners to think about as well from this whole conversation, because there's so much in there, is that, again, I've outlined the kind of person, I think anyway, that listens to this show, the people that reach out. But I think if you are someone who engages with, your content, my content, like I said, maybe you're a healthy person trying to get healthier. And sometimes people will say to me, well, with the work that we do, you're only reaching a certain kind of person. And the people that need it the most often are close to maybe this conversation. Maybe they don't listen to podcasts. Maybe they don't want to read that book. Maybe they say to you or I, well, actually, I've got bigger problems right now than thinking about my happiness, because I've got debt, maybe my child is ill, maybe I'm overweight and I'm struggling with this or this or this. And actually, when you're we know there's a direct correlation between wealth and health, and people who are in real social economic problems saying, Adrienne, I hear you, but or other people who listen to this show, to be able to have that conversation with the person they think needs it the most. So what you've just described then, when you take that empowering mindset, you change your mindset, and it might be the person's mother, it might be their sister, it might be their boss, it might be someone who they're like, I know this is true and I'm living in this way, but that person who needs this help, they're so close to it. We all know those people, don't we?
We do.
They're defensive, they're angry, they're really close to it. How can people, I suppose, have this conversation or get them to buy your book or listen to what we're saying with an open mind?
It's difficult. It's very difficult. To address the first point there, yes, your socioeconomic status absolutely plays a role in your health and happiness, no question. I have worked in a place called Oldham for nearly 8 years, right, in the past. I don't work there anymore, in an area, very low socioeconomic status, a big immigrant population, lots of benefits, not much money, a lot of poverty and struggle. I have been applying these principles for years with patients in low-income groups because, here's the thing, even if your life is tough, even if you have to work two jobs to make ends meet, if you learn to choose your reaction to certain situations, you are going to show up as a better version of yourself in your life, no matter how tough it is. If you learn some simple breathing exercises, right, which can help switch off your stress part of your nervous system and activate the relaxation side, you are going to make better decisions in your life, even if it's tough. So I think that's a really important point I always like to make clear for people. You can still apply some of these principles no matter what your life is. Mm. Edith Eger conversation just showed us that.
Yep.
So that's the first part of it. The second part, just feeding off from that, is talking about happiness. Where does money fit into that, right? Most of the research suggests that once you have enough money for your material needs to be met, like shelter, food, and safety, most of the research suggests that more money will not make you happier. So I get it. If people aren't earning much at all and they're struggling, yes, striving to earn more will make a big difference. Mm. But the way I phrase it around money and happiness is that the way I put it is that money removes common sources of unhappiness. I don't think money brings happiness in and of itself.
Yeah, I suppose it, as you described then, if you have enough, then money gives you choices, it gives you agency, it gives you freedom. But once you have enough, as you described, I always say you don't need more than more.
Yeah.
Because if you have enough and you have a bit more and a bit more and a bit more.
You always want more.
Yeah, and you can't, it won't change anything really.
So, but then to the final part of that question, which is how do you get it to people around you who you love? This is the commonest question I get at events. Dr. Chashi, I've got your books, I've made changes, I feel great, but I can't persuade my mum or my best friend to do it. And I don't think we can.
Right.
Right? And I don't mean that to be a negative answer. People are ready for change when they're ready for change and not a moment earlier.
That's really powerful for people to know, because I wasn't expecting you to say maybe you can't, you know, maybe they won't.
I've had to say that when I first got into the whole lifestyle medicine piece, when I realised how much agency we had over our lives, man, I was trying to tell my whole family, my mum, my dad, I was trying to tell everyone. And you know what? Sometimes they don't want to hear it, especially from people close to them.
Yes.
Right? Especially from people close to them who they've had a relationship with for years. Mm. You know, it's... The best way you can do it, in my experience, is not to lecture them or try and persuade them, because often it's just not received in the same... You know, I don't know if people can resonate with this, but in most relationships... I remember a few years ago, we were skiing, my wife and I, and we met this other couple, and we were skiing with them. And earlier in the week, I've been trying to... I was trying to share some helpful tips for my wife when skiing. I hope I was trying to share them. Didn't go down particularly well. And then we were out skiing with this other couple, and the guy ended up skiing with my wife for a bit, and she came out and said, oh, you know, he gave me these great tips on how to do this. And I was like,
hang on a minute,
I've been saying that for the last few days. But what I realized then is that actually it's not heard in the same way.
Yeah.
You don't hear, it's the same words, but they just don't resonate in the same way as when it's someone that little bit removed. Mm. So I think be the example, right? You live your life, right? You don't get triggered by them. Work on that. You change your diet and your sleep and show up as a calmer, a more energetic and more peaceful person. And when the time is right, they'll say, hey, listen, I've noticed that this happens a lot. I've noticed that you used to be quite reactive here, or actually you've got so much more energy, or you look fantastic, whatever it might be. That often is them inquiring. Going back to what I said about smoking before, telling someone else what to do never tends to work well. So be the example, and they'll come and ask for advice when they're ready for it.
Absolutely. And I have that same thing, the word energy that you just said, that's the one people come to me for. I don't say to people, yeah, you should do this or you shouldn't do that, or I would never, as you said, I don't tell what people what to do. Yeah. I always say, show, don't tell. But when people come to me, or they'll listen to me talk, or we'll meet and they'll say, how do you have so much energy? And, you know, and when that's the question, isn't it? When someone asks you, then they're ready to receive it.
Yeah, now they're ready.
Yeah, absolutely. So on that note, let's talk about the Power Hour.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Love it. One of my favourite topics.
I can't wait, because regular listeners will know that, you know, the Power Hour in its simplest form, for me, the first hour of every day, it's become, you know, it's been six, seven years I've been doing this. It's my non-negotiable time. I reclaim the hour and it's for me. You know, I used to share my Power Hour on social media. So I'd do an Instagram story at 5:30 in the morning when I was out for a run, or, you know, maybe at 5:45 saying, oh, I'm reading this book, or I don't even do that anymore because it's really for me now. So it's always, you know, the first hour, whatever time you get up. It's not about doing more for the sake of more, you know, achieve productivity. It's actually a kind of a bit of a counter where there's so much of the world fighting for our attention. For me, the first hour now, it's about solitude. It's about doing something to start the day the way I want to. And you know, really just, yeah, I guess before I go into the busyness of mum life, work life, emails, social media, it's just my first hour and it's changed my life. I love hearing from other people what their morning routine is, if they have it, why they have it. So Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, I've been waiting for this one. Tell us about the first hour of your day and what time does it typically start?
So I was too excited to answer this question. I love morning routines. I've used them with patients for years to help them with all kinds of different health problems. I've had it myself. I like to start the day and get up before my wife and before my kids. I'm a better person in every aspect of my life when I have time to myself each morning. So I have a framework that I talk about called the three M's for morning routine: mindfulness, movement, and mindset. Now, to be really clear, yes, I think it's a very complete way to do it, and I hope it's useful for some people. But, you know, if you just want to do one of them, even that, it's going to yield benefits in your life. So as things stand, because I'm constantly tweaking this, right? It used to be a lot shorter than it is now, but I'd say it's probably at least half an hour now. Sometimes maybe up to an hour, actually, maybe at weekends, but I'd say at least 30, maybe 40 minutes these days. So I get up usually by 5 o'clock,
yep.
Okay? Sometimes even earlier, but 5 o'clock, what I'll do, I'll come downstairs, live in a house, come downstairs, sit in my pajamas, I'll go to the living room, and I will do a mindfulness practice. At the moment, it's a breath hold meditation that I learned about in November. So it's about 3 or 4 minutes of meditation to really relax my body. Then I do a series of breath holds, mm-hmm. which literally is just wonderful. It's a really great way to see where you're at each morning. You know, what's the state of your nervous system? How well did you sleep? You can really tell in your breath hold time, actually, yeah. what's going on. So that's what I do. That's probably, I don't know, 15 minutes or so, okay, in total. Then I'll go to the kitchen and I make coffee. And I'm very precise with it. I weigh it out, I put it in the French press, pour the water in, then I set a timer for 5 minutes. That's how long I like my coffee to brew. In those 5 minutes, I do some form of workout, just 5 minutes,
right?
In my pajamas. So I make it really, really easy. It could be a bodyweight workout. There might be a kettlebell in the kitchen that I'll swing around or do something, but I will do some form of 5 minute workouts mm-hmm. that doesn't require me to get any equipment or look anything. I keep it really, really simple. That's why I've rarely missed a day in about 3 years now, because I made it part of my routine.
Yeah.
And then I go to the third M, which is mindset. And mindset is doing something positive to get your mind in the right state of mind, in the right frame for the rest of the day. And that, if I'm by myself, that will be, you know, drinking my coffee that's now ready with an uplifting book. You know, I've got a few books kicking around in the living room. I'll sit there and I'll read sometimes a chapter, sometimes a few pages, sometimes more if I have more time, that makes me feel good and, you know, think about the world. That's it, right? These days it's getting brighter. You know, I'm becoming more hippie and spiritual as I get older. So I will go barefoot in the garden, you know, just try and hear the birds sing.
Yeah.
But roughly speaking, that is the framework I use. Mm-hmm. And on the days where I convince myself, which is rare anymore, I don't have time. I just need to crack on with the emails today. You know, I always notice it later. I'm more reactive. I'm not as productive. So I've done that enough times. Again, I don't beat myself up when that happens. I use that as a learning opportunity to go, you're a better human being when you have your morning routine.
Yeah.
So I generally will do it pretty much every day. Mm. And I've had patients who say, "Doc, I can't do it." I said, "How long have you got? Could you do 5 minutes?" One lady, I remember, single mum, really busy life. She had really bad skin problems. I felt stress was a big driver of her skin problems. Mm. She did a 5 minute morning routine, and it was the three M's. 1 minute of a breathing technique that I call the 3-4-5 breath, when you breathe in for three, hold for four, and breathe out for five. 2 minutes of some of her favorite yoga sequences, and 2 minutes of positive affirmations, right? That changed her life,
yeah.
right? It led to a ripple effect, and about 3 months later, she hardly had any skin problems because her stress levels went right down. So I am a big believer in how you start the morning is, you know, how you do the rest of the day. But I will also say, if you are someone who doesn't think the morning is for them, okay, let me meet you where you're at, right? Maybe the tools you share or the tools that I've just shared now, maybe you can do that at another part of the day, right? Maybe use that 3M framework at lunchtime or in the evening before dinner. But some part of the day where you take time to nourish yourself will pay dividends for your health and your happiness.
Absolutely. And people do sometimes, because they've probably heard me say it so many times, as you said earlier, when you hear it from somebody else, it lands differently. So I think that's also what I love about asking people this question, is that everybody's answer is different.
Yeah.
You know, I've interviewed so many people on this show and everyone's answer is different, and the guests get different things from different people and it can land in a different way. And I really love that as well with just 5 minutes, because everyone, you know, will say they're time poor and they're busy and, oh, maybe I can do the power hour just once a week. Maybe I'll just do it on a Wednesday, or, you know, and I say, fine, exactly, meet people where they're at. If you want to do it once a week, great. But if you are so time poor and so busy and so overworked and so stressed, if you're giving to your kids, to your work, yeah, to everyone else all day, so much so that you can't give yourself 5 minutes, I really think that you have to reassess. You have to look and say, you deserve 5 minutes a day. You deserve, I say, an hour a day, but don't think that it's self-indulgent or it's selfish or you don't have time because of X, Y, and Z, because as you've just described, whether it's a skin condition, whether it's a feeling of just raised cortisol and stress, yeah, and franticness is what I find if I don't have my power
exactly.
hour, it's franticness, because I am a busy person, a lot of energy, doing a lot of things. So for me, it's how I counteract that busyness is by feeling calm and not frantic and knowing that you deserve that time, whether it's 5 minutes or an hour. You have to prioritize yourself and your own health and your own happiness.
Oh, couldn't agree more.
Oh, it's been so great having you here. I've absolutely loved it. I'm glad we finally were able to meet in person to do this. It's been fantastic. Yeah. So thank you so, so much.
Oh, not at all. Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks everyone, as always, for tuning in. We are taking a short break from the Power Hour for a couple of weeks, so I'll be back very soon. We've got an incredible lineup of guests coming for Series 5, so have a great few weeks, stay safe, and I'll be back soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.